MechCast, Saturday, November 12th, 2016. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Glad to be sitting down here with you for yet another episode. We've been doing this for a long time now. It's always good to get back into just finding out what's going on in the world of Apple and the Macintosh and iOS devices and all the other iThings that we have. And this week, there's not a ton of stuff going on, but we got some things to talk about. Some interesting information coming out about the MacBook Pro, specifically how sales are going. But also, I have some thoughts and opinions on just the machines themselves. I know we've been talking about that for the last couple weeks, but I think it's going to continue as now machines are actually arriving in people's hands, and we're getting some firsthand reviewer information and data that I think is interesting to talk about. Also, we're going to talk about new iPhone rumors, both with the existing models and what's happening with the next generation. Apple's making a little change with how they're selling ads in Apple News. We're going to talk about them cracking down on some app stuff and what's going on with those AirPods anyway. We've got all of that, and then your feedback, some follow-up to the whole syncing apps back to iTunes. I got some news, good news for you there. I got a question or a little bit more follow-up on Gary's question from last week about getting images back into the camera roll. Question about HealthKit data and how that all works. We're also going to dig into the storage on your iPhone and figure out how maybe you can free up a little bit more additional space. So it should be a great episode. And why not just dive right in to the first story, and that is MacBook Pro sales. Despite what you might think, and I've heard from a lot of you about your thoughts on the MacBook Pro, a lot of people feeling like it shouldn't have the Pro name on it, that Apple hadn't done enough updates to it to kind of have it earn that Pro moniker. Maybe some people feel like the lack of 32 gigabytes of RAM as an available option means it isn't Pro. There's a lot of people saying some things that aren't so nice about the MacBook. And you know, and we talked about this a little bit, I piled on a little bit early on, but I'm coming around. I'm starting to recognize what Apple has done with this machine. I still think it's a little bit overpriced, but I'm coming to grips with it. And more than just coming to grips with it, a lot of people seem to be really liking the machine, at least if you believe order numbers and some of the reports that are coming in. We got a report this week from Slice Data. This is the company. What they do is they monitor online order receipts for like 4.4 million accounts or something like that. And they see what people are buying and what they're spending and what they're doing. And their data seems to show that the new MacBook Pro has already generated revenue that would be equal to 82% of all the revenue that was generated by sales of the 12-inch MacBook since it launched. So just in a couple of weeks, it's been able to do that. They also say that according to their data, the new MacBook Pro has generated more revenue than any other laptop that's gone on sale this year. So Apple is at least generating a lot of money for these things. And again, this is all within the first few weeks of sales. And this seems to back up statements that were made by Phil Schiller recently. He said that the MacBook Pro has had more orders than any other Pro model Mac that Apple has ever sold. So, you know, despite what people are saying, a lot of people are buying these things. And some of that, I think, could be pent-up demand. And you might be thinking, like I'm thinking, well, that's going to trail off. That's going to go away. But Apple's already reportedly told their parts suppliers to expect strong shipments all the way through the end of 2016. This is according to DigiTimes. Originally, Apple apparently had been very conservative about orders going into the launch of the new MacBook Pro. We had heard those things, that Apple was being kind of conservative. But now, since the October announcement, that apparently has changed. The report claims that Apple has stepped up component orders and is trying to step up production to meet demand. There's also a report that claims that Apple has added a second supplier for the OLED touch bar as the original supplier is having trouble keeping up with demand. And some analysts are now thinking that Apple could ship as many as 15 million MacBook Pro units by the end of the year, and they expect the sales to remain strong into 2017. So it doesn't look like it's going to be slowing down, and Apple should be making a lot of money, even though they bumped up the price. I guess that means they're going to make more money. So maybe Apple made the right call here. And again, now that reviewers are getting a closer look at the MacBook Pro, specifically the Touch Bar models, a lot of the negative reactions seem to be calming down a little bit. We're starting to realize, hey, these things are pretty nice machines. Are they pricey? Yes. But are they overpriced? Well, maybe depending upon your perspective. There's a lot of nuances that go into here when you're looking at the machine as an overall package. Is it capped out at 16 gigabytes of RAM? Yes, that's absolutely true. Does it matter, though? And again, people, as they're testing and using these things, the answer becomes maybe. It might not, though, matter as much as you think it does, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. And then, is the Touch Bar incredibly cool? Hell yes, that thing's amazing. Does it increase productivity or workflow? I was skeptical, but we're looking like maybe. It is showing a lot of promise in early reviews. We're hearing a lot of good things, specifically from people who are pros, who are doing audio editing, video editing, those sorts of things. And they're saying, yeah, this is actually a kind of cool way to work. It surfaces a lot of the controls and things that I need when I need them. They're right there. I'm not having to do keyboard shortcuts. I'm not having to remember those things. I'm not having to go up to menus to drill down into things. It's just, boom, immediately there, available to me. And that is potentially speeding up workflows. And if it can do that, that's good. So, you know, what's changing the hearts and minds of people? You know, and I think this sounds like a cliche, but the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Or I think more accurately, or better said, it's because of the sum of the parts that the whole is great. And I talked about this a little bit on the last episode. It's the incredibly fast SSD storage. It's the best in the industry from all the reports that we've been reading. The super fast RAM and the combination of those two things, even though you're limited on the RAM to 16 gigabytes, because you have such a fast SSD, if you get into a memory situation where you do need to go and start doing paging, which is typically when things start to slow down, they're noticing the MacBook Pro is not doing that. So even when you're taxing the system, the SSD almost becomes like an extension of the memory, at least if you're going to believe the review from Robin Harris over at ZDNet. And I have to say, it sounds logical, right? If you have fast, solid-state storage that works really well and is integrated really well with the controllers and the entire system, again, as a whole, it's really going to optimize the performance, and you're not going to notice the slowdowns. Now, is it good that you're having to get to a situation where you're maybe paging out stuff? Probably not. I mean, that's not really what you want to be doing. But the point is like, it's not going to slow you down in terms of using the machine. And Robin also points out that, you know, the software is a big part of this thing. You know, Mac OS is doing some amazing things under the hood, including memory compression, which lessens the burden on the whole memory system. So the chances that you're going to get into that situation where you're going to have to start paging out things are less with a MacBook Pro and the Mac operating system than you might have with other comparable systems that are out there running other OSs and things like that. So Apple's ability to tweak the hardware and the software and bring it all together and do that at a really low level is what's really making this thing shine and sort of push it over the top, even though when you look at the specs in and of themselves, yes, we've got, you know, a little bit older processors and things like that. When you look at some of those other specs, you might think this is not as good as something else that's on the market. But real-world usage and people getting these things in their hands seem to be proving otherwise. There's been other pro video editors who have been chiming in, and they're saying that for many of their daily tasks, the differences once you go over 16 gigabytes of RAM aren't as great as you think. So comparing a 16 gigabyte RAM system to a 32 gigabyte RAM system, it's not that big a deal. And Phil Schiller pointed recently to a Huffington Post piece by a Final Cut Pro editor. And he said, you know what? I've been using the system. I've been editing 5K video in Final Cut 10, and it is buttery smooth. It is working great. He also said it was outperforming supposedly superior spec Windows-based machines, at least in his testing. Now, I'm taking that with a grain of salt because Phil Schiller specifically pointed to the article, and I think there's, you know, some maybe Apple finagling there because the guy has a 13-inch MacBook Pro with the Touch Bar, didn't mention specifically how he got it, and those things are just starting to arrive in the hands of people. So he may have had a little help from Apple, but still, I tend to believe him because I'm seeing this backed up by other things. I saw a video out there on YouTube that was comparing the speed. This was the non-Touch Bar MacBook Pro, but basically he took some video editing projects and was exporting them. In this case, it happened to be just 1080p, but he was exporting them to H.264 and was comparing the MacBook Pro to the HP Spectre X360. And on the Spectre, he had the newer Kaby Lake processor running at a higher clock speed, I think like 2.7 gigahertz, and put it right up against the MacBook Pro, which had slightly lower specs. And the MacBook Pro was able to render that video in about a minute and 30 seconds versus almost 9 minutes for the HP. So you have to wonder what's going on here. Here you have a machine that supposedly on paper, on specs, should be vastly outperforming this MacBook Pro, yet the MacBook Pro is smoking it. Now, granted, some of that has to do, again, with the software. He was doing the rendering on the Mac in Final Cut Pro 10, I think, or whatever the comparable encoder is for that. I'm blanking on the name right now. And, you know, using whatever was available on the HP Spectre. I'm assuming something like Adobe Premiere. But the point still stands. When everything is optimized, when everything is fine-tuned, performance is going to be there. The other reviewer in the Huffington Post piece also commented that, you know, the combination of the hardware, the fast SSDs, and the software was all pulling it together for Apple to really make this a quote-unquote pro system. So, yes, some users and their use cases will need things like more physical RAM. But I'm thinking, and this may be where Apple's thoughts on this were too, that more and more of those cases where someone who's in the market for a pro notebook is going to need a system that has more than 16 gigabytes of RAM, they're more on the edges. They're more on the fringes. It's not saying that those people aren't out there, but when Apple was faced with the decision of what do we do if we want to maintain battery life performance and get these machines out the door with the processors that are available from Intel, what's the call to make? And this was the call that they chose to make. And it's looking like, from, again, these real-world tests, that it was maybe the right call to make at this time. And I think at some point they will switch over. They will upgrade the processors to the newer stuff when Intel makes it available. And hopefully at that point they do some rejiggering and maybe give some more RAM options. And that could happen sometime in the first part of 2017. We really don't know what Apple will choose to do. But I would expect them to do a spec bump when and if they're able to make the spec bump. But that doesn't detract, I don't think, from what these machines are now. Right now, they're the right machines for the right time, or it's feeling like that. And again, based on the sales numbers, it looks like a lot of people are siding with Apple on this one. So again, wherever you fall on this, I'm still welcoming your comments. If you totally disagree with anything that I've said, I'd love to hear from you. If you're in agreement, I'd love to hear from you. So send me some feedback. Let me know what you think. MacCast@gmail.com. As you probably know, when Apple released the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 7 Plus, the hot new item, which it always is, anytime Apple does a sort of new color or new style of an iPhone, that becomes the hot new item. The hot new item was the jet black, and it still remains the hot new item. If you want to get an iPhone 7 Plus and you want the jet black, that is going to be the phone that you're waiting the longest for. So you have to understand, when I saw this next rumor, I immediately thought, wow, this is really sketchy, and I can't believe Apple would do this. Mac Takahara is, they're occasionally correct on iPhone rumors, so, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility, but I'm just having a hard time believing this one, because they're saying that Apple is planning to do a high-gloss white version of the iPhone 7 and 7 Plus. They're calling it jet white. I think it should be called, like, Snow White or something like that, or what would be something that's glossy and white? White out? I don't know. I'm thinking of like hurricane stuff. Something that would be totally glossy and blinding. But even I admit, or even they admit rather in this piece, that the source might be quote unquote unreliable. And the fact that Apple is struggling with the jet black model and getting those out the door, I don't know why they would want to add yet another color choice. But again, Mac Takahara did correctly predict the jet black model, so maybe we'll give him a little bit of leeway on this one. I just don't think it's really happening. What about next year's iPhone, though? We're hearing a lot of rumors about that. One question I think I have is what is it going to be called? The natural progression would be iPhone 7S and 7S Plus, but most people think that Apple's at least going to go with a full bump because it's the 10th anniversary edition of the iPhone, and they're expecting a major redesign. So it could be the iPhone 8, or will they just jump all the way up to iPhone 10 for 10th anniversary edition? Who really knows? There's a lot of speculation flying around, and we've talked about a lot of it, but the latest that we're hearing, beyond the fact that this next generation iPhone might have OLED screens and an all-glass design and be curved, is coming from Barclays this week. Barclays research analysts say that there's going to be new phones that are coming in new sizes, or at least new screen sizes, a 5-inch and a 5.8-inch, but the devices would be borderless or bezel-less, however you might want to say it. So presumably, they would be able to retain or at least be close to their existing sizes and form factors. So we're going to get bigger screens, but the same size phones. And that would bring it more in line, I think, with some of Apple's competitors. And I think that's a natural move to make. I certainly wouldn't want to see the phones getting any larger physically. I'm very happy with the size of the current 4.7-inch iPhone. That's my personal favorite. And as I talk to a lot of people, they're all for bigger screens, but really don't want bigger devices. So in the past, I would have maybe dismissed the idea of a rumor of a 5.8-inch model. As a matter of fact, I probably did back when Ming-Chi Kuo was saying Apple was working on a 5.8-inch model. That was earlier this year. But the fact that Apple may be able to do it without, you know, bumping up the form factor, that has me more in line. I think this is likely going to happen, that Apple will go with larger screen sizes. I don't know if OLED enables that to some degree as well. Maybe that's something that can help. Some have said that Apple could achieve a larger screen and keep a smaller case size by removing the physical home button entirely. This year, we know they went with the non-mechanical version. But Barclays says that Apple is going to keep the home button. So the screen's going to get wider, but not taller. It's not going to move or encroach in that space where the home button might be. And apparently, bezel-free seems to be the buzzword of the future, at least when it comes to Apple products, because Barclays is also saying that Apple is going to introduce three new models of the iPad early next year. They say there's going to be a refresh of the 9.7-inch and 12.9-inch models, but that Apple would also be adding a new bezel-free 10.9-inch model. So again, same physical size as the 9.7, but with a larger screen. And once again, this is not the first time that we've heard rumors of a 10-plus-inch iPad design. It's been thrown around that Apple was going to go with, I think, anywhere from 10.1 to 10.7 to 10.9 inches. So why would they do three models? Why would they still have a 9.7 if they're adding a 10.9? Well, reportedly, that would remain on as an entry-level iPad, the lower-priced iPad, and the new 10.9-inch would sort of replace the current 9.7. Other likely updates that we might see in the spring with new iPads would be bringing the True Tone display technology and a 12-megapixel EyeSight camera to the 12.9-inch iPad Pro. And it's also being rumored that all models would get the quad speakers and would retain the 3.5-millimeter headphone jack, which I find interesting. Although, if Apple keeps it in there, it sort of backs up their case that with the iPhone, they needed the space. And presumably on an iPad, they'd have plenty of space to fit in speakers and everything else that they wanted to fit in and still keep that 3.5-millimeter jack. So 3.5-millimeter jack still stuck around on the MacBook Pro update, and it looks like it's going to be on the iPads as well. So good news for fans of the 3.5-millimeter jack. I'm not a big user of Apple's news app, but I do occasionally go in there, and there's some good content that you can come across. And I don't know if you know sort of how the revenue model works for Apple News, but basically publishers can put their stuff in there. They can sell their own ads into their content, but then also Apple has an opportunity to sell and put ads in the content as well for anything that is unsold. So if there's extra inventory within those publications, Apple sells their own ads, and currently they sell them in-house and they keep 30% and then the publisher gets 70% of that. Well, a Recode report this week says that Apple is planning on stopping selling the ads themselves beginning in January, and they're going to turn that over to NBC Universal. As far as what happens with publishers, nothing else is really going to change, at least according to the report. Publishers are still going to be able to sell their own ads inside their own content and keep that revenue. And Apple will sell any remaining ad inventory, or rather NBC Universal now, after January, will be selling that additional inventory. And the same deal remains in place. I guess NBC Universal will be keeping the 30%, and then the publishers get the 70%. And for their part, NBC Universal has said that they're actually going to set up and create a dedicated sales team just for the Apple News app. Apple has recently removed hundreds of fake shopping apps from the App Store. This wasn't even something that I was aware was going on. It's an interesting kind of scam, and it seems to be beefing up, probably going into the holiday season. What appears to be happening is that ne'er-do-wells are placing fake shopping ads with misleading icons and misleading names to try and trick shoppers into downloading the apps, and I would assume scamming and getting their credit card data and personal information. The counterfeit apps have been seen for retail chains like the Dollar Tree and Foot Locker. Also, big department stores have been spoofed, like Dillard's and Nordstrom's, and even online stores like Zappos, Polyvore, luxury good makers like Jimmy Choo, Christian Dior, and Salvatore Ferragamo. I think I did okay on that one. But basically, these things were popping up, and Apple was finding and removing the apps as quickly as they could, but it was like a giant game of whack-a-mole. The perpetrators seemed to be just creating new apps and new developer accounts, trying to slip things past Apple's curators. So it's been apparently a big problem for Apple, but they're really cracking down on it. I would say, if you're going in this holiday season and you're planning on using an app to make your purchases, just make sure that you're paying close attention to, like, the developer on that app, what the name of the app is. Because a lot of these, if you looked at them closely or were paying close attention, it was pretty obvious this wasn't the legitimate website. So look at the icon, look at the overall design of the app, and maybe any other indicators that might give you a hint that, hey, this is not kosher before you use that shopping app. Kind of stick to the names, you know, make sure it's coming from that publisher and not some weird site out of China that is just trying to spoof and trick you into giving up your personal information. Since Apple launched tvOS and tvOS apps more specifically, it's been sort of tricky for developers to get them to you. If you remember way back when they first launched, at first, the only way to find them was literally to kind of do a search or just browse through the stuff that Apple was featuring on the App Store on the Apple TV. Then they started to improve things. They started adding categories and organizing things a little bit better. That made browsing a little bit better. And then they followed that by the ability for developers to put out links to web previews. So you could actually view the Apple TV app in the browser, get information about it, see screenshots, but they didn't have any direct purchase links. There was no way to actually buy them. And then back in September, they added to tvOS 10 the ability to set up automatic downloads. And this worked good if you had a companion app on iOS that also had a tvOS app. If you enabled that feature, then that app would be automatically downloaded and installed on your Apple TV. Well, now it's looking like Apple's getting ready to maybe make the final steps for developers. They've added the tvOS apps to their iTunes Link Maker tool. And this is a tool that developers can use to actually create links to their apps. But by adding tvOS apps to that, that means developers can now build links that will directly link to the tvOS app on the App Store or on iTunes, to the App Store on iTunes or the App Store in iOS. And that means you can now directly buy a tvOS app on those devices, even if it's a tvOS only app. So what will happen is you'll buy it there and then you'll have it available to install on your Apple TV, or if you have the automatic installation set up, then it will automatically be installed next time you get to the Apple TV. And that had been one of the early complaints, both from developers, I think, and customers about, hey, it's just too hard to get these apps. I want to be able to buy it. You know, if I read about it on a website, I want to be able to click a link. I want to be able to buy it and then have it automatically installed on my TV when I get home, or my Apple TV when I get home. So that is now looking like it is now possible. And then I'm going to end the news for today with probably the question that is on the hearts and minds of a lot of Apple fans right now. And that is, when are we going to get to buy AirPods? You know, Apple announced them. They showed them off to us at their event. They said they would be available in October. And then they quietly sort of just said, yeah, we're not going to make that shipping time. We need more time to get these things right. And they changed the messaging on their website to simply state coming soon. But they haven't given us any hard date on when we will be able to buy AirPods. And as we discussed last week, supply chain checks seem to be indicating that they might not even ship at all this year. That's a pretty big faux pas, I think, on Apple's part, to get out there and announce them like they're going to be ready in a month and then not even get them out the door at all in 2017 seems pretty bad. Not to mention, it would blow by the holiday selling season, which would be a prime time to actually make some money off of these things. But this week, we got a rumor from an employee at an Apple reseller called Conrad. He reportedly told a customer who heard from his uncle, who heard from this guy who thinks he knows the cousin of Phil Schiller, that he said, okay, you get the idea. I'm not really putting a lot of stock in this rumor. What actually happened was this guy who supposedly worked at Conrad told the customer that they would be getting AirPods in stock by November 18th or 19th. So probably by the time you might be hearing this episode, supposedly they would be on sale. But again, this is just like one of those things. Someone walks into a reseller and says, hey, do you have AirPods? They go, no, but I hear we're going to have them next week. So I'm not putting a lot of stock in the rumor. It was reported on last week by a number of news sources, and I just wanted to kind of give a little clarity about where that rumor was coming from. Now, a little more reliable source, one we referenced earlier in the podcast, Barclays, they think that Apple will have a January launch of the AirPods. So again, not going to be here this year. And I just shake my head. How could Tim Cook have been so wrong? Tim, what happened? And Apple's, of course, not saying. I think that's another part of this question is, what is causing the delay? Because you would assume it was the W1 chip, this new chip that Apple designed that does all the cool pairing and syncing and stuff like that, or pairing, rather. But that chip is out and available in a couple different Beats headphones. So that's probably not it. So what's going on? I'd love to know. But Barclays sees the AirPods entering production sometime in December, which would mean that Apple would get them out, missing the lucrative holiday window, sometime in early 2017. And my guess, though, is even missing that holiday launch window, probably not going to matter. These things are going to be in high demand. Apple is going to sell a ton of them. And of course, as we always hear, reportedly supplies are going to be extremely low. Estimates are that Apple will have between 10 to 15 million pairs of AirPods ready to go in January. That's not going to be enough to meet the demand, that the pent-up demand that we're sort of seeing. So I'm feeling like this is going to be Apple Pencil all over again in early 2017. So if you want some AirPods, have your cash and credit cards ready, and be ready to be stalking the Apple Store to maybe get your hands on a set of those. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Eero. Stop and think for a minute how much your life right now depends on the quality and reliability of your Wi-Fi network. You know, it used to just be our computers and our smartphones that we needed to get connectivity with, but look around your house. Just like take a quick assessment. I know I've done this recently, and I'm just overwhelmed by how many things need an IP address on my network or on my Wi-Fi network. We have tablets, we have lights, thermostats, toys, more refrigerators, toasters. I don't know what you have on your home network. It's a lot of stuff. And it's not just that. We also rely on our Wi-Fi for our entertainment. Services like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and HBO. And we're taxing the heck out of that. We ask a lot of the network. And when it has issues or goes down, that can really be devastating. It can be frustrating. Who wants that? And as we put more demands on our networks, traditional routers and range extenders and things like that are not cutting it. And that's where Eero comes in, because Eero is a wireless system. They are small, little elegant boxes. They look like they could have been designed by Apple. They're really beautiful, about the size of an Apple TV. And what you do is you buy one, it replaces your existing router, and it is hardwired into your cable or your DSL modem. And then you have additional Eeros that you just plug in to an outlet. It's literally, you take it out of the box, you plug it in, and you put these around your house to give you full and total coverage. Because what they do is they work together to create a mesh network that covers your whole entire house in fast, reliable Wi-Fi. Think about it. Does it really make sense to have a single point of access for your Wi-Fi network? No, you want access and points all over your house that are equal, that are all delivering the best possible connection you can. And that's what you're going to get with Eero, because you can connect to the nearest Eero, and it's just like connecting all the way back to the Eero that is sitting there connected to your wireless cable modem, your DSL router. These things were specifically engineered to, you know, just blanket your home in Wi-Fi. And they're super simple to set up. Setup and management is a snap. There's a simple app that walks you through the entire process. I literally had my system up and running in minutes. And if you do somehow have an issue with the setup, they have great support. You can get a hold of a Wi-Fi expert in about 30 seconds. Just call them up and they will help you out. And they're constantly improving the system through frequent software updates. As a matter of fact, they just added a new parental control feature. It allows you to create profiles for everybody in your family to manage internet access, and you can do it on a schedule or on demand, however you want. After setting up and testing my Eero system, I was amazed. I was immediately getting full, consistent throughput speeds, the full bandwidth of, you know, available on my network in all parts of my house, and reliability was incredible. It was really an immediate, amazing improvement. So I really encourage you to try out Eero. There's even a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you really have nothing to lose. Plus, if you order now with the code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T, you'll get free overnight shipping. So you can have it immediately to try it out. And just visit Eero.com At checkout, select overnight shipping and then enter the promo code MACCAST, and that's going to make your shipping completely free. So try it out, Eero.com, and a big thank you to Eero for their support of the MACCAST. Last week, we talked about app thinning. I had a question about, you know, why when I update my iPhone, I get a new iPhone, or I restore from a backup after erasing my iPhone, is it that suddenly all my apps have to re-download, and I have to go through this process of waiting for all my apps to re-download? And part of the reason that that happens has to do with this thing called app thinning. If you don't know what that is, go back and listen to the last episode of the MACCAST. But one of the questions that we were kind of left with, and a theory that we threw out there, was that a possible workaround, a possible way to not have to re-download all the apps would be, before you did your erase, go into iTunes, connect your iOS device, back it up, bring all your apps over, and then not only that, make sure that you download directly from the App Store all of your app updates. Because if you're doing over-the-air updates on your device, those aren't synced back. So you have to pull down all the current versions of the apps that you have installed into iTunes and have them available. And then the theory was, erase the iPhone, and then when you restore, your iTunes would be able to sync all of the apps back onto the device, because they're going to have, it's going to have the full versions sitting right there. Now, I didn't have time to test this out, but the person who had asked the original question, Mark, did, and he got back to me this week, and he said, yep, I tested the theory, and it worked beautifully. I had all of my apps there installed locally, or downloaded locally to iTunes. When I did my erase and restore, everything synced back locally from my local iTunes. So that did work for him. I haven't confirmed that myself. I'm just going to throw it out there. I haven't had time to do that, but I trust him. I have no reason to question him otherwise. And for him, making sure that all of the apps were updated and stored locally when he recovered his iOS did do the trick. So that was great news. Great to hear that. And thanks, Mark, for getting back to us on that. Now, you may also be able to force individual apps to reinstall from your local copy by connecting your device to iTunes, going in, selecting the device. So I'm thinking the scenario where you've already done the restore, you've got a bunch of stuff that's downloading, but you want to kind of speed up the process. You might try connecting your device into iTunes, selecting the device, and then going to the apps tab, and then looking through the list of apps that are there. And it, once again, if you have a local copy already downloaded, I would assume you'd be able to still click the install button to force that app to install directly from iTunes. You may have to remove it first. Just be careful there, because that may also remove the app's data. A little word of warning there, but you should be able to force that app back onto your iOS device directly through iTunes. Another thing we talked about last week was Gary was looking for some ideas on how to get photos back to the top of his photo library, or more specifically into his camera roll. I'm still debating, are we calling that camera roll anymore? I think your photos just go into photos. But the point is that he had some third-party apps that he was using where I think it was like a postcard app. So you go in there, and you need to select a photo from your library. And if it's buried really deep in your library, it can be somewhat cumbersome to find, especially since third-party apps don't offer up a search option. They just give you kind of the browser, and you have to swipe through. So you want to know, how do I get those to the top? And we gave a couple of different ideas. We suggested some things. But after hearing them, Donna had an additional tip and some additional thoughts.
Hi, Adam. This is Donna, and I'm providing some listener feedback for Gary from the last episode. He had a question about photos in third-party apps. And one thing that I know he mentioned, which I found doesn't work out really well for me, is the snapshot just at the screen of a photo, because I don't think those are the same quality as the original photo, because when I've had some things printed, they didn't come out very well, and I have a feeling that's the reason why. So I try not to do screenshot of items for that reason. But I understand you're making a separate album. I did that when I was using Groovebook, because it's 100 photos. So I had like Groovebook number one, Groovebook number two. They managed to totally mess it up anyway and send me mostly repeat photos. and missed about two-thirds of the photos I wanted printed. So, haven't used them again. However, one thing I think he may want to try, rather than favoriting them with the heart, because the issue with that is then that also links to your Apple Watch, and you'll see all those as favorites, even though they may not be. So, and then you may have to go and delete them from being favorites. I don't know if it's any easier, but there's this great little arrow called a button called duplicate, and I didn't know about it for the longest time, but you can actually duplicate a photo. So maybe right before he goes in to use whatever app it is, he could just duplicate all the photos that he wants, and then they should show up at the very top of his, whatever they're calling it today, camera roll, et cetera. And then it's really easy to just pull them into the app and use those for printing or postcards, whatever. So I just thought he may want to try that instead. Hopefully it's a higher quality if you duplicate than if you just do a screenshot. Thanks.
Hey, Donna, thank you for that tip. Yeah, that is actually a cool little thing. One quick comment on the iOS screenshot thing. Yes, absolutely. If you're using a screenshot, it's going to end up being a lower resolution because what's happening is you're going to get it at whatever the resolution of the iPhone screen that you took the screenshot on is. So, for example, it'd be 1334 by 750 on an iPhone 7, which is not a lot of resolution, especially if you're sending something for physical printout, which I think is was exactly what Gary was doing. He was sending it to a postcard app. I was assuming it was a print postcard app where, you know, it prints it out for you and then sends an actual physical postcard in the mail as opposed to a digital postcard. If you're sending a digital postcard, that might work okay. But your idea to actually, you know, access the duplicate option and just simply duplicate the photo works out really well. It jumps right to the top of the photo library or of the photos application. Again, I wish I knew. I don't think Apple has a new word for the camera roll. Let's just internally, let's all agree we're just going to call it the camera roll, okay? So it jumps right to the top of the camera roll. And for those who don't know where that duplicate option is, you actually, what you do to get to it is you select the photo in Photos, and then, because this is so intuitive, yes, I'm being sarcastic there, you tap the share icon. And if you swipe along the action icons on the bottom, because it's easy to forget that the share icon is also where you access different actions, action extensions. So swipe along the action icons at the bottom and you will find the duplicate icon. And then you can tap that and you can duplicate it. Interestingly, there are also some other handy photo actions that are hidden inside the share icon, including, and I guess this is somewhat pun intended, the hide option. So this is the thing, if you want to be able to hide an image inside your library without actually removing or deleting it. So maybe you have some images that aren't your best images, you just want to kind of get them out of the way, but you don't want to take them out of your library completely. You can use this action to actually hide them. And if you want to reorder the order of actions so that they're not so far down the list, things like duplicate and hide, if you just simply tap the more button in that share panel at the end of the actions list, then you can turn them on and off, you can reorder them, and you can kind of reorganize them the way that you prefer. So, great tip, Donna. Thank you for sending that along. I personally do not use my iPhone or my iOS devices much for the health application, and I only have a single iPhone, single Apple Watch, that I actually feed data into my health app from. So I never really thought about this next question, but Alan sent in an email. He was going back and forth with Apple support because he does have multiple devices and he does do, say, for example, step tracking on both an iPod 6th generation and an iPhone. And he had naturally, I think this would be a natural assumption, he had naturally assumed that if he was syncing all of that data into the health app, that it would sort of match those things up. So, you know, the data from both would kind of be synced together and merged and put together to form his step counts. It actually doesn't work that way. And Apple support pointed him to a support article that explained exactly how it does work if you have multiple devices feeding data into the health app. And this goes not just for iOS devices, but also if you have fitness bands, if you have third-party apps that are putting app data into the health app, you know, how does that all work? So instead of aggregating and syncing the data points from different sources, what it actually uses is a priority system to determine which bit of data is going to be the data that it's stored. And the default way that the health app prioritizes the data out of the box is it starts with any data that you enter in manually. That seems pretty obvious. Then any data from your iPhone, your iPod Touch, or your Apple Watch. And then finally, data from any third-party apps or Bluetooth devices like fitness bands. Again, that's only the default. What happens, though, as you add new devices or new apps to the system, it takes a last-in, first-out or in approach. I guess it'd be first-in since it's the data going in. But basically, the last device that you added or the last app that you added is going to be the one that is the default for any given activity or health data point. So, for example, if you're doing step tracking, so if you have your Apple Watch, but then you add a new app that is going to track your steps using your iPhone, it's going to use the iPhone app if you're using the app for tracking your steps. Obviously, if the app is off and is not running, then it will fall back to your Apple Watch. So it goes down the list, starting from the most recently added thing and then moving down the line and sort of following this hierarchy. Luckily, you can actually change or reprioritize that. If you wanted to see what the current order is and how things are set up, you can actually go into your device, open up the health application, tap on the health data, and then tap on a category like activity. And then you can swipe down to reveal a search bar and then enter the thing that you're looking for. So like tap a data spec like steps. And then if you go into steps, there is a thing called data sources and access. And when you tap on that, you'll be able to see the items that are in there and see the hierarchy that they are in for any given data type. Again, like steps, or if you're looking at your nutrition information or whatever it might be, all of these can be set up for individual data points, and you can control the order of any of these things. If you want to see all of the devices or apps that are contributing to data, you can tap the little sources tab down at the bottom of the health app, and then you can drill into an individual app or a device to see the data or activity categories that that thing is contributing to. To reorganize the data priority of any item, again, you're going to open up the health app, you're going to tap on the health data, then you're going to tap on a category like activity, then you're going to tap the data type, for example, steps, if you wanted to change the order of steps, you're going to tap on data sources and access, and then in that screen, tap on edit. And then when you tap on edit, you can touch and hold the little list icon, the little three lines, and you can reorder those, moving them up or down the list. And then when you set that, that is going to be the new priority order that the device is going to go through in terms of providing data into the health app. And just remember that the item at the top of the list will always have the top priority, and that when you add a new device or app that contributes to that data point, to that data type, it will now become the new default. It will be the thing on the top of the list when you add it. So if you don't want that, you're going to have to jump back into the health app and you're going to have to reorder the way that thing goes. So again, I hadn't given this much thought. I hadn't looked into it too much, but wow, there's a lot to think about here. And Alan, thanks for pointing this out for us. Okay, the last thing that I want to finish up with is a question. You know, I think a lot of things about our iOS devices are a little bit of a mystery, but one of the bigger ones to me is actually what is taking up the storage on my device. Apple provides some tools for us to kind of see that, but they don't give us a lot of specific detail. It's kind of more like we've got these little boxes and there's some stuff in there, but don't ask too much about what's specifically in there or how to like clean that out. And specifically what I'm talking about is if you connect your device to iTunes, right? And we've discussed this a little bit, but if you connect it into iTunes and you click on the device and you go in and you look at the different types of data that's stored on there. It groups it into these categories, right? You get audio, video, photos, apps. Those are pretty straightforward. That makes sense. That's how much, you know, how many apps, how much storage my apps are taking up. But then you have this other category, right? And we've talked about that a lot on shows. So if you want to get into that, go back and listen to some of the prior episodes. But another section that is there is called documents and data. And this isn't really clear what this is. You know, it you can infer and kind of understand, okay, this is documents and data related to the apps. So it's separate from the apps, but it's information that's related to it. It's stored in this little different area that Apple calls documents and data. Looking on my iPhone, for example, I have about 10.56 gigabytes of documents and data. So that's a lot of documents and data, and I don't know specifically which stuff goes with which apps or anything like that. I just know this is app stuff. So it's a little bit esoteric, right? And don't even get me started. This is just one in a long line of things that are confusing about how iOS devices store stuff. Don't get me started on why iTunes shows me a different amount of free space on my device than I get when I go into settings, general storage, and iCloud usage. When I look in there, it says I have, for example, 52.21 gigabytes available, yet iTunes says I have 51.37 gigabytes available. I prefer the one that the iOS device is telling me, but you know, why does iTunes think that I'm using 1.1 gigabytes more of data than my iPhone does? Beats me. So presumably, you know, again, the documents and data is stuff that is stored by individual apps. Okay, we can accept that. But if you go and check this by going into settings, general storage and iCloud usage, and then click on manage storage and then start tapping on your apps, what the first screen will show you is it will show you the app's total storage plus the storage that's in documents and data. If you drill into that app, if you tap on that app again, you can actually look and see the actual amount, supposedly, of documents and data storage that that app is taking up. But if you went into every single one of your apps and you grabbed that number and you added them all together, they're not going to match up with the total amount that documents and data is reporting inside iTunes. So it again, you start to wonder, okay, what's going on here? What's this extra stuff that's not being accounted for? And the assumption would be that it's things like cache files. You know, iOS and macOS, and they use a ton of cache files. These are files that are stored by the applications, bits of data that it keeps around to speed up performance, to make things faster, to make it so you're not having to download so much stuff over and over again from the internet. And on our Macs, it's nice because we have these utilities that we can use to go in and just clear out that cache data, because this is transient data. It's data that we don't need around forever. The apps will re-download it if it needs it. And if we need extra space, we can clear this off. We can use utilities like Clean My Mac 3 or Cocktail or Onyx, right? We know these utilities, we've used them, and you can wipe all that stuff out. But with iOS, you really don't have that option. In some cases, you can use the apps themselves. They offer a way to kind of purge that cache data. Safari is a great example of this. If you go into settings, Safari, you can clear history and website data. And if you do that, it's going to clear out the Safari cache. Third-party apps, some of them also offer that. So if you have an app like Flipboard, or in my case, my RSS reader, gives me an ability to go in and purge the image files that it's downloaded, but not the cache files. And I actually tried this to see, you know, how much storage could I get back by purging the downloaded image files that are in Reader. And when I looked at documents and storage in the usage data, I had 135.7 megabytes used up before I cleared the cache and 135.3 megabytes after. So those images weren't taking up very much data. So again, what is using up that 135.7 megabytes in Reader of documents and data storage? I really have no idea. I have no idea how to go in there and visualize that to see that. And it really would be nice if we had a way to do that, I think. A better way to get in and manage the individual documents and data inside iOS. I don't know how you feel about this, but this is kind of how I feel about it. And specifically, it would be really nice to have a universal way to be able to clear all the cache files, especially when you need to quickly free up some space on your device, because each individual app maybe doesn't have very much of this stuff, but in aggregate, the total amount of storage that all these cache files are taking up can be quite significant. It could be the difference between being able to do an app update or an OS update or not. And so it'd be nice if we had a little bit more control over that. Whether Apple will actually ever give that to us, I'm not really going to hold my breath on that, but just wanted to make a little commentary about that. This was something that actually Kirk McElhorn over at Macworld was talking about as well. And I'd been thinking about this for a while and was in total agreement with him. So I don't know. What do you think? Is this something that bothers you? It doesn't bother me on a daily basis, but it comes up from time to time and I notice it. And when I do notice it, it's one of those things that's like, oh yeah, that really could be better in iOS and I wish it was better. But give me your thoughts, maccast@gmail.com. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information, details on all of Smile's great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a question for me, a comment, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're welcome to send me emails and audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. That telephone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you'd like to follow me between shows or just send me a message, interact with me there, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or if you prefer Google Plus, we are there. There's a Google Plus community at google.com/plusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.